Welcome to the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host Arsen Kashkashian. Joining me here at the KGNU studios with a returning author. We first had this author as a guest on the book club way back in the Wayback Machine, so many years ago. So Arsen, I'm going to let you introduce him. Who have we been reading for the month of November?
We've been reading Robert Garner McBrady. And The Problem You Have is the name of this short story collection. And we did have Robert on the show back in, I think, 2016. It was probably when it was.
It was one of our earliest book club episodes. But we're delighted to have you back in the studio, Robert.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Hello, Arsen. Hello, Maeve. I very much enjoyed the last interview. Yeah, I believe around 2016. So it's great to be here again.
Well, this is a new collection of short stories, and it's called The Problem You Have. And all the protagonists throughout all of these stories are having many problems. In fact, for many of them, we're meeting them on what's probably the very worst day of their lives. But one of the things I do want to explore with you as well is that it's not all doom and gloom. There's a tremendous amount of humour within these stories, even though the characters themselves are really struggling. So tell us about the themes that you wanted to explore. As I said, they're really having a bad day, to put it mildly.
That is putting it well. They are having bad days. Some of the themes... I wanted to show characters in sort of an extreme situation. That was one of the themes in the book. And then also, as the title says, The Problem You Have, it's sort of revealed that the problem you have is that this one particular character has a conscience. And if he doesn't have the conscience, he won't have a problem. But since he has a conscience, he has to navigate these, he or she has to navigate these difficult situations, trying to figure out what's the right thing to do, and often being maybe confused about what the right thing to do is. There's a lot of themes of aging, I think, as well, where... people are coming to the ends of their careers or lives, things like that. So some of the issues that older people confront show up quite a bit in the book. At the same time, though, there's some ones with younger people as well. So I was really hoping to have a variety of types of characters and situations, even though there are a lot of similar themes, but yeah,
the variety is really interesting because, like you said, I mean, you've got a story with the guy who used to be a boxer. You have a story of a pitcher on the mound. Then you have stories with two couples meeting. Like, one's a massage therapist. You have a guy who's retiring and swimming out towards a buoy with a shark near him. There's just all sorts of different things going on. And so where are you coming up with these characters? And you know, a lot of times in the story collection, either there are link stories or there's almost of a type. And no, I mean, the settings are all different in here. You're all over the place setting wise. So how do you come up with all this and still make it hold together so well as a collection?
Well, you know, when I write a collection, I'm not originally writing it as a collection. You know, I'm just writing stories, individual stories. And then at a certain point, when I've got enough of them, and often I look to have a fair amount of them published first in various literary magazines, because then I feel like, well, they had to be good enough, smooth enough to get into those magazines. So it's kind of like they've already had a good edit at that point. So as the stories accumulate, at a certain point, I go, well, you know, maybe I've got enough for a collection. So this is actually my fifth collection of stories. And it just began to seem like it was time. So I started looking at the various stories I had, and And one of the things that did seem to kind of put them together in a way was that theme of the extreme situations, danger. I was kind of surprised myself, actually, as I started reading these stories and go, man, there's a lot of stories with danger and violence in there. And I guess what surprised me is that was more than in my past collections.
Well, yes, all these characters, as you said, you're putting them into extreme situations where they're battling an event. They're also very much battling inner demons. Like, these are a bunch of, and it's mostly the men who seem to be having these issues. They're really battling their own issues, and they seem to be struggling, whether it's their marriage or it's a relationship they're in or want to be in, or they're, you know, there's just stuff going on in their lives. Then you have that and you're putting them in these extreme situations. And we mentioned a few. There's a guy who's out swimming and he starts to get into a bad situation. There are a lot of situations, as you said, that have violence, a lot of guns. And it's not necessarily the character themselves has the guns, but somebody they encounter has a gun. And that's often an extreme character as well. So why do you think you decided to explore more of this, you know, aspect of violence or having those type of situations?
I wish I had a good answer for that. It just seemed to be like what was coming to me a bit or haunting me. You know, some of them were from experiences that none of them like exactly as what happened or anything like that, but something that would sort of trigger the story in a way. So, for example, in A Morning Swim, where the man swims out and encounters a shark. That did not happen, but I had an incident where I swam out into the ocean, and when I turned back, the current had turned against me, and I came quite close to drowning. And so that incident always kind of haunted me, and it was like trying to find a way to write about that, but add in some other features to it. So somehow the shark showed up. And I think I've always been kind of, you know, interested and frightened by sharks. So, and then I thought about that could all be connected to relationships as well.
Yeah, the way you described that swimmer who, the shark is one problem, but he's also having a hard time getting back to shore. So over a year ago, I was on a vacation with my family in San Diego, and we witnessed a guy getting into trouble in very similar circumstances on the beach. And it's so bizarre to watch it and to, well, I wasn't going to jump in, and I had my kids and they weren't going to jump in, but these surfers ran out and were able to rescue him. But afterwards, everyone was really just completely freaked out, let alone the person who experienced it. But just that idea of being in the sea, not even that far out to sea, and to get into trouble, take away the shark, you've got a shark thrown in the mix as well. It's really wild to witness it, but I can't even imagine to be in it as well.
Yeah, I mean, there really was a feeling of when I got to shore that, wow, somehow I've survived that. And yeah, as you say, though, it, not being that far from shore either, and in fact, looking at people on shore and thinking, you know, should I shout for help? And but somehow thinking that I was like embarrassed to do that. And I wonder how many times people die or get into trouble just because they don't cry out for help. And but when I got to shore, I do remember this overwhelming feeling of kind of like gratitude and, you know, how wonderful life was. And so I also wanted to express that through in the character. But then when I wrote that story, I thought, well, that's a little too pat, you know, like just that alone. So then I had to add that complication where, you know, he goes and tells his wife what has happened. And then things, I won't say too much about that, but things don't go as he had hoped that they would go.
I think the violence and the danger you talked about immediately heightens the tension in the story. And it's, your fiction is very realistic fiction, so it's not like cartoonish at all or anything. So you have to kind of deal with it as a reader. You have a story where, you have a couple of stories where people witness things, like the guy who witnesses the fight in the bar, a fight right outside of the bar. Mm-hmm. And it ends up being quite a vicious fight. And then that's what, where are you going with him, right? That's the bar
where
fight
you,
one.
Where are you going with him?
And then also you have another one where, I think the title story, where he's in a car when the driver runs over somebody, you know?
Right, right.
And has to witness that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of where this idea of conscience comes in, too. Mm-hmm. It's not just the person who creates the problem. Sometimes it's a witness has to react in a way. And that seems to be a source of great drama for you.
Oh, yeah, Arson. I think that's a really good observation. You're right about the witnessing a crime. And what do you do as a witness? And especially one of them is set in a foreign country and puts you in a very awkward situation. And another one to report the incident is to get other people in trouble and ruin their lives. So it's a tough situation to be in.
Well, not all the stories have violence. And in fact, we're going to get you to read from one of them, which is really interesting. And, you know, an example of the light and the dark and the comedy that's throughout most of these stories. And this is about a baseball pitcher who's just refusing to give up. So talk us through what this story is and then we'll have you read from
us. Oh, okay. Love to. Yeah. So, definitely an over-the-hill baseball pitcher. Very, very minor league. But has always had the dream of going to, you know, playing in the upper divisions, Major League Baseball. And, of course, the dream by this time is long past. He's never going to make it. But somehow there's still a little bit of hanging on to that dream. And I guess what I wanted that in that story was that people could relate to that in other ways, you know, so not everybody's setting out to be a Major League Baseball pitcher, but we all have our dreams and hopes. And I even, you know, I guess I was thinking of it some ways of writing, you know, and so presenting somebody who's kind of really maybe past his time, but is still at it, still trying to pitch. And he's what we call in baseball, they call a closer, who comes in just like in the last inning, and he's supposed to get the batters out. And if he doesn't, it's kind of like a big failure, you know, that he didn't close the game out well. So that's kind of where Smitty is coming from. And this one, I would say, like Arson had mentioned, realistic stories, and this one kind of bends reality a bit. There's a couple in there that are sort of a little bit more absurdist in nature. And I'm glad that you mentioned the comedy because, yeah, I do like to have a comic element in my stories, at least some of them, and some tension as well. So kind of working with both those aspects in the book.
Well, we'll get you to read from that particular story.
I'd love to read here. Smitty's on the mound. Ninth inning. And Smitty's the closer. The leadoff batter connects hard on the first pitch, a fastball that's not so fast. And Smitty takes his cap off on this sunny afternoon to cool his head and watches the ball soar all the way to the warning track before the right fielder makes a heroic leap to save the ball from going over the fence. The fielder sprawls on the ground and holds his glove up to show he's made the catch. The few fans scattered in this out-in-the-desert, end-of-the-road Bush League stadium applaud as the fielder staggers up, shakes his head like he's received a chiropractic adjustment, throws the ball back in and resumes his position. The fans give him another round of applause, and the fielder waves and tips his hat. Hot shot, Smitty thinks. Just make the catch without all the drama. But the near homer shakes Smitty up, gives him that slack feeling in his legs he knows too well. Stop. He's talked to his therapist about this kind of insecurity. Think positive. The majors are still possible. At his age? Who is he kidding? Washed up without ever really getting going. Stop. He walks the next three batters, throwing the ball in the dirt to the sides. Squatty the catcher diving to stop the ball, dusting himself off, removing his face guard and banging it on his thighs to clean the dirt off, blowing out hard breaths, as if the throes have exhausted all his patience. Even the ump shakes his head and looks disgusted. That's harsh, Smitty thinks. Those pitches weren't so bad. Bases loaded, one out, the clueless home field fans jeering, and now he's staring at a righty at the plate, their best hitter, standing with a wide, threatening stance, drooling at the mouth, wagging his bat, theatrically pointing his to center field in a clownish Babe Ruth impression. Give me a break. We'll show you, Babe. Two more balls in the dirt, Squatty blocking the throw with his mitt, and shin guards barely checking the runner on third from stealing home. There's nothing Squatty hates more than a stealer. He's a short, fierce little bastard with hairy forearms. No genius behind the plate, Squatty signals what pitch to throw. One finger, now two, now three, now a thumb and a finger. Now Squatty appears to be shooting the finger at him. The ump leans over Squatty, the two of them whispering to each other, and the batter turns his head and all three chuckle together. Skipper, the head coach, has come out of the dugout, getting in on the signaling, making the sign of the cross on his chest. His hands move to his head. Something's gotten under his cap. He's scratching frantically at his skull, and he's doing some kind of tap dance, one hand in his hair, the other clutching his crotch. The batter is getting bigger. The wagging bat itself is turning into a huge piece of lumber that's going to drive the ball right back at Smitty, knock his head off. It's like his reoccurring dream he's told his therapist about, where a line drive knocks his head off, and then blind, he's searching for his head in the infield, kicking it like a soccer ball while his father, an old Marine, screams at him to throw the head to first. Wow, that's a good one, the therapist had said. Were you afraid of your father?
That is our guest, Robert McBrearty, reading from the short story, Smitty's on the Mound. And it's part of the new collection, The Problem You Have. And that's been what we've been reading for the month of November here at the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. Now, Smitty's father is remembering back to his dad, who was in the Marines. There are a few of the stories that actually have a military essence to it. And one of them, there's a man who's, oh gosh, he's really coming towards the end of his life. He falls, he can't get up, he's trying to get to the bathroom. His son is telling him, Dad, we got to get you into an assisted living place. And he's having these flashbacks the entire time of when he was in the army and had to leave a friend behind. And he's at some point, the two realities seem to merge, him lying on the bathroom as he's struggling in the present day as he's coming to the end of his life and the flashbacks. So do you have a connection to the military yourself, or what? Why was it that you wanted to include so many of the stories that have a military connection?
Well, that one was really influenced by my father a lot. My father showed up in the Philippines in World War II, just after the war had ended. And so he's part of the occupation forces in the Philippines. And he would talk about that there were still Japanese holdouts in the jungle. And sometimes the jeeps would be fired upon. And that was something I heard as a child. And I always somehow wanted to write about that, and so I dramatized it and made it that it was my father's jeep fired upon, and that he has to do an escape through the jungle with a friend. And then I wrote, I mean, this was like, I was hearing these stories when I was, you know, quite a young kid, and just wrote that story, you know, maybe just a couple of years ago. And my father then, as he got older, started taking all these falls. So somehow I put that together, you know, like juxtaposition, you know, the scenes in the jungle and then the scenes of falling. And so the father, while he's in that state of being on the ground, is, you know, reliving this these memories.
You know, I used to do the series of call-in shows here at KGNU on end-of-life issues, and mm-hmm. we did one on hospice care for veterans, mm-hmm. because so many folks have lived through these mm-hmm. experiences. Mm-hmm. and they never talk about it. Mm. And then they get to the end of their life and they're having these really either flashbacks or just dealing with the traumas that they've lived through. I mean, this idea that it doesn't matter how many years ago or decades ago you experienced these things, very likely it's going to come. You know, you're going to have to deal with it at some point. And if you have never dealt with it, it's probably going to be at the end of your life when you're struggling with so many other things as well. Was that something your father ever talked about, really? I mean, he said he shared the stories, but...
You know, it was interesting. He was very young. He was like 18 or 19 and already married. He and my mother was like 17. So they were married. And he first was... stationed, they sent him from, they were in San Antonio, and then he was stationed in Denver for about 6 months before shipping out overseas. And he would always talk more about his time in Denver. Like, it made quite an impression on him. You know, he talked about the winter, you know, because in San Antonio, you don't experience too much winter. And then you say, well, Dad, what about the Philippines? And then he would, you know, he talked about how, you know, we went to Elitch Gardens and all that. So in some ways, he was very fascinated by his time in Colorado, which I always thought was kind of interesting. But definitely at the end of his life, he was having a lot of, you know, memories of various kinds.
You know, I think one of the most beautiful parts of the book is towards the end of that story when he's thinking back, the character Ed, and he's with this, when they've escaped, they've made it, and him and Dickie is the friend he escapes with, and Dickie's really upset. And Ed, as he's now at the end of his life and he's on the floor or whatever, he thinks, I should have held him. Mm. I should have just taken him in my arms. Mm. He was so upset. And I just thought that was a beautiful moment, kind of that realization. And at that point, an old soldier being able to realize that affection was what was needed.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Orson. Yeah, yeah. And in some ways, too, I think about a moment like that where I'm kind of saying it for myself, too. Like all those times that maybe I wish I had held somebody, you know, like maybe you don't know what to tell them, but just, you know, hold them, you know, when they're hurting, just be there for them.
Well, as you were saying, you have... these characters are in an extreme situation, and often it's another extreme situation layered on top. So we talked about the guy who's out swimming, he gets caught up in a current, but there's also a shark. So it's, you know, he's dealing with two things. The very last story really reminds me of that. You have this professor on campus who, we won't give too much away, but he ends up being on an LSD trip. And he's trying to teach and he's going around campus. And it's really funny, like, because he's a professor of poetry as well. So how he's describing what he's going through is really, really quite funny. But then he's in one of the most ultimate extreme experiences, let alone being inadvertently tripping on LSD. He finds himself in the middle of an active shooter situation as well. I mean, could you not give some of these characters a break and just let them deal with one extreme situation, but you're like just layering it on top. So talk a little bit about that, because to me, that story exemplifies the light and the dark, that you manage to find those tones really well, the comedy, but then there's extreme tragedy and real sadness in it. But also, you know, one extreme situation hurtling into yet another extreme situation.
Yeah, you know, I think one thing in that particular story is that really terrible events are so terrible that they might seem to have kind of an unreality about them. And so I wanted to put the professor where he's already in a state of unreality. So how do you... And when you're already in a state of unreality, how do you deal with a situation that is actually real, but is also seems unreal? So I think I was really playing with varying levels of reality in that story. And even, you know, when before the shooting occurs, you know, the professor is he no longer knows what's real and what isn't. And, You know, he says, am I sitting here in this booth, or have I actually already been run over by a car? You know, he doesn't know. And so in that case, I guess, you know, the extremes of the mind, you know, in some of the other situations, we had dangerous situations, but here we have a dangerous situation, but we also have the mind just in a very disturbed state, wondering what's real and what isn't.
So also in that story, there was one of my favorite quotes, and I thought it described a lot of what was going on in some of the book. And it was, she was a young woman who had not often been confused because she had the good sense not to want too much. And, you know, this wanting too much or wanting something or, you know, desiring something often can be a downfall of a character, even if it's something simple, like in the opening story, to be in some place warm, like you want, you know, or... And I talk about that, like, you know, what do your characters want and how does that start affecting, you know, the guy who had to swim? He'd been told by his wife not to swim because there was a shark in the water. But now he's like, well, we haven't heard about the shark for a little while. I really want to swim. So, but it seems like that's a way into these dangerous situations or this conflicts that people have is their wants.
Yeah, they have their wants, and then... sometimes the wants maybe could be a little bit unrealistic, you know, like most likely you're not going to get there, you know, what you want, but they, you know, they're maybe driven by that that desire and that want, and of course things get in the way, you know, along the way, and that's where a lot of the tension can come from, you know, the want and then the obstacle to, you know, fulfilling that want. Sometimes on a very basic level, I was thinking about the first story, you know, the cold night in Waterloo, where the, in this case, a young man is out on the highway, out on a country road. Basically, he's going to freeze to death if he doesn't get warm. And he wants to be warm, you know? So on the very basic level, he, you know, as you know, he gets into a terrible situation as a result of that. But it starts with just a simple desire for warmth. Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk a lot more with Robert McBurtie in our After Hours at the Radio Book Club podcast edition. So make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss that content, because we're going to explore the art of the short story and how you actually frame it, because you pack so much into all of these books, all of these stories. But in the meantime, we're going to say goodbye to the radio audience and thank Robert for joining us today. Thank you, Robert.
Oh, thank you, Maeve. Thank you, Arson. I really enjoyed it very much.
Well, as we always do at the end of each Radio Book Club episode, we announce what we're reading for the next month. So, Arson, what is the last pick for the year 2025 for the Radio Book Club?
Well, it's another bolder author. It's R.L. Mazis, A Complete Fiction, where it's a novel where one writer accuses another of plagiarism over social media. And then things spin out of control.
That's a really interesting discussion, especially, as you said, the social media. We've got cancel culture. We've got a lot of modern themes in that. So do tune in on the fourth Thursday of December to hear that conversation. But don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. For KGNU and the Radio Book Club, I'm Maeve Conran. As always, my co-host Arson Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Thanks, Arson.
Thank you, Maeve.